back with episode 547 of The Critical Myth. I got the number right. Excellent. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and that's why I always feel uncomfortable in Radio Shacks.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and I'm actually interested in hearing some of Edmund's discussion on one of the shows this week. Extra interested, rather.
I imagine so. And talk about rocking the cradle of love. Anyway, we are going to be talking about the shows that we did not make the top three or the bottom three. And considering that there were only 14 episodes to discuss this week, it could be a somewhat short conversation, but we'll see where it goes. Edmund, before we do any of that, you probably have one small job to do.
Yes. As ever, I need to warn you that there are all sorts of things we might discuss about these episodes, and if you haven't seen them, they will spoil you horribly. They may scar you for life in some cases. But as ever, we've tried to give you a week or so to catch up before we do that to you.
That's right. And, well, we're going to start with a show that is slowly but surely wrapping up its second season in proper form. But, once again, we have to remind that we have changed to a slightly different schedule. So it's kind of unusual that we are talking about a show after we've already seen the next episode. So we're going to have to keep our minds firmly on which episode we're talking about.
Yes.
Anyway, the show is The 100, Season 2, Episode 14, Bodyguard of Lies. Clark and Lexa prepare for battle.
Yes, you do.
I do, in fact. See, this is what I'm talking about. Whatever the case may be, I'm not going to go back and look it up. It's the show before the season finale started for the 100, and therefore, it actually got very quickly eclipsed by the actual first part of the finale because my brain is I'm unable to switch back to this particular episode. No, this was, again, them setting up the stage for the massive battle with Mount Weather and the alliance between Clark and the quote-unquote Sky People and the Grounders under Lexa's care, I guess you could say, or command. Mm-hmm. And this one had some interesting little twists and turns. This one is probably, if I'm remembering correctly now, the one that is slightly infamous because it got celebrated greatly when it turned out that Clark was not necessarily sad to get the romantic attentions of Lexa.
Yes.
It was just bad timing, I guess.
Mm-hmm. She still kind of has that whole,
Sparks were flying into just about every guy, and many women in the audience are a little jealous of Lexa.
There is also the whole issue of,
Again, number one, I have no idea what Skype's doing to Edmund. I think it's lagging a little bit. Catching up. Okay. Okay, Edmund, go ahead. I'll just let it. Whenever Skype lets you talk.
Even though our technology is apparently well behind that of the 100, or at least of the Sky People. Clark, of course, has this whole thing of trying to lead a battle and, getting over, having to knife her previous boyfriend. Even though we're only getting to it, this week, I was actually rather amused and bemused that it seemed to be the theme of that entire week of shows when it started with the Grateful Dead, the Grateful Dead, the Walking Dead.
Well, that's a completely different show.
Yes. Well, that would be an interesting show, a musical version.
Huh? Yes.
Where we had, of course, Aaron's infamous kiss, setting the internet alight. And then as we kept going along and it was like, same sex kisses are our theme for this week. But, But yeah, it the thing I liked about it was as the 100 has done so well all along was that they weren't putting a lot of emphasis on it. It just sort of happened, and it was like, oh, okay, that's how you feel, and no, I'm not averse to it, but hey, we've got a battle to fight, I've got a few things to work out, and just moved on, which I really do kind of like the way that we have reached that point in the TV landscape where, as opposed to Ellen back in the mid-90s announcing that she liked Laura Dern to an entire terminal of people, it doesn't have to be an event anymore. The way they've been building up this battle and the dynamics of it, the show just really continues to impress with how they accept the situation they're in and really run with it, and certainly, I mean, from, you know, when the series was first announced and everybody was just like, oh, Hunger Games ripoff, to the way that they have taken this really hard science fiction premise and just completely stayed true to it. They're just, continuing to deliver a very satisfying show.
Yeah, obviously there's always a very high body count here. And I thought that it was interesting that, you know, you mentioned Clark is, has pretty much attracted everybody on the show so far, as far as I can tell. But, she's a leader, and she makes it very clear that as much as she, in better times, she may be willing to look into, you know, possibilities. Then you've got other characters that choose to indulge at this particular moment, and all it does is create the exact kind of complications that Clark is hoping to avoid.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting kind of dynamic that they're exploring, all without compromising on the just brutality of what's going on. I continue to be impressed by the fact that they're not hiding that, you know, Mount Weather is essentially continuing to a program of gouging fully conscious young people with basically apple cores to take their bone marrow out while they're still fully conscious. It's nasty because you just see them with these bandages with these really very prominent circular red spots. You just go, oh yeah, that's kind of clear what's going on there too. How wonderfully painful and traumatic. They're going to remember that for a very long time. Anyway.
Yeah.
Just a great, great show. And it's certainly, I don't remember if I mentioned, but this particular episode got an 8.25. So it was certainly once again above average. And I do feel like just very quickly taking a look here, this season is, while it's just slightly above last season, that's still at an 8.1. So that's a pretty good for two seasons now. It's been right up there at the above average mark.
Yeah. A couple of things have come back to me about that episode, but you touched on it a little bit, but after the slightly forced triangle between Raven and Finn and Clark, I thought the way they built up the Raven and Wick romance was actually felt much more organic. Since these are two people who basically are being forced to work together on things that they know a lot about, and so it was feeling more like a meeting of equals. And also I like the fact that they didn't pull any punches on this whole bizarre Jaha quest to the City of Light. And, yes, they get through the minefield and discover that, we apparently have another wasteland. So it's there is no magical place is just going to make everything better. It's we are still talking about a devastated Earth, and none of this is going to be easy.
Yeah, that that whole revelation of the City of Light being just one big solar field.
Yes.
That was hilariously evil. But anyway,
although, hey, they are solar panels. Basically, they work if sunlight, shines on them. So, there may be something they can do. But not quite the Emerald City at the end of the Yellow Brick Road they might have been hoping for.
You know, But they, you know, the one side of that is there was that drone. So
yes.
Where was it going?
Yes. Exactly.
So there is that.
Exactly.
All right. Well, I think we've really kind of highlighted yet again that the 100 is inspiring a lot of interest and a lot of praise. There's another show that's relatively new that I'm still just amazed that the show is really knocking it out of the park. Mm-hmm. And that would be 12 Monkeys, Season 1, Episode 7, The Keys. Cole, Rayleigh, and Aaron race to stop the virus from being deployed as a bioweapon in Chechnya. And this episode got an 8.25. And wow, this one was surprising, if only because, once again, they play things out in a way that you think they're just going to hit the reset button somehow, but...
Mm-mm.
No.
Yeah.
Also that, and I take some small satisfaction out of them portraying a Snowden-esque character as a complete and utter ass. Yes. And yet somehow it fits. Yeah. Anyway.
You think?
A little bit. But, you know, having somebody who is obviously a whistleblower and with very little consideration for what the consequences are of it, working with terrorists in Chechnya is somewhat suggestive of in terms of commentary, that's for sure. But it also throws out the question of who's really the good guys and the bad guys here.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the fact that even the people that you're kind of rooting for to eliminate the threat, their motivations are not the right ones necessarily. It's a real mess.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's that whole question of, wait, did they just kill who I thought they did?
Yeah, exactly.
What else would you add to this?
Yeah, no, I'm this is the thing was, and it kind of amazes me that here we are I haven't checked on, I'm assuming this is one of those typical Cable, like 13 episode season orders, that they're just halfway into the season and they've already played with this many time travel, paradoxes and scenarios admittedly one not quite so successfully, but they've done a very good job on everything else they've taken on. And certainly this whole thing of, you know, no, sending him to die, knowing it's going to happen because it's because of the nature of the way he gets sent back and forth. I really was stunned at them pulling the trigger on that. Sorry, couldn't resist. As I've mentioned many times before, I have my policy of not watching previews anymore, but this time I really did. Actually, it was a case where, I mean, it's just automatic now, where I shut the episode off and then I thought about it and said, no, wait a minute, I want to see what they're actually showing or not showing about next episode. And sure enough, that, you know, the preview was pretty truncated and was not giving anything away about, you know, no, is Cole actually showing up or not? If anything, it was reinforcing, you know, no, she's in the rubble saying, yeah, we did it, he's gone. So they've gotten me very intrigued to see, okay, did you really just do that and get rid of one of your main characters, or if not, I'm now quite confident in them figuring out some way to bring him back that actually feels genuine.
Yeah, well, when you've got time travel involved, it's always the question of which version from when did you
exactly
eliminate?
Yeah,
you know, is that from iteration 12, 15? How many? You know, but yeah, anyway,
exactly, exactly. You know, and they've already gone there, so they've already established that.
Yes, exactly. So I mean, it's like you're just asking the question of all these little things that you're throwing out as possibilities and plot points, so to speak. Which ones are actually meaningful and which ones are just red herrings? Yeah. And you really can't tell.
Yeah, exactly.
One thing I just have to point out is that my wife loves this show, which is hilarious because usually shows that I watch, she barely tolerates. She really likes this one a lot. She thinks it's hilarious that there's this movie that we are even somewhat slightly dismissive of because we only really cared about it because a friend of mine was an extra in it.
Right.
And now it's like this show that she's like devoted to, and it's just like... funny how these things work out.
Yes.
Anyway, let's see. Gary, you haven't really been able to weigh in for a little bit, but apparently you did watch this next show, so if you don't mind doing the recap here.
Yes, we're talking... Oh, yeah, I haven't been. We're talking about The Americans, Season 3, Episode 5, Salang Pass. Elizabeth takes family matters into her own hands. Meanwhile, Stan turns to Sandra for support after receiving upsetting news.
Mm-hmm. And we gave this one a collective average of 8.17, which is, if I just want to very quickly check, I don't think that's too far off from what the average is. In fact, no, this show continues to be a little bit of an underperformer this season.
Yeah.
And, I think, Gary, for this episode, you gave this one the lowest score at a 7.5.
Yes. I really didn't feel like much was happening. It felt like I didn't even think they were building to stuff in this episode. I mean, I know things are happening and it'll advance the storyline and things like that, but I just didn't feel like we went anywhere. At the end of this episode, I didn't feel like much had changed at all. I didn't know more. Nothing really happened from the beginning to the end that made a difference of anything that I felt. And so it was rather lackluster for me. I'm not saying I need to shoot them up special, but it seemed like a filler episode almost. And given how short their seasons are to begin with, why do they need that?
Edmund, it seems to me like you disagree with that quite a bit because you gave this one a 9.
Yeah. So
we have a very varied bit of opinion here.
Yeah, I mean, for me, this was the show getting back to what it does best. Part of it was giving a very strong episode to Matthew Rhys, where we're seeing him both as Clark, and that whole scene, which was a little odd, but I guess this is how foster care happens, or at least how it happened back in the early 80s observing potential foster kids. Having that whole plot line with Martha continuing on. But of course in this episode, I mean, that being set up as the contrast to the continuing, recruitment / seduction of Kimmy, as uncomfortable and distasteful as that is becoming. I mean, both for Philip himself, and for the audience. I think it was again, we're in this situation where, yes, I've seen the next episode too, but it was really starting to come to me with this episode where as good as I think both Matthew Rhys and Kerry Russell are, with Matthew Rhys, there is this sense when he is putting on these different characters where I am sitting there watching it and it's like, I forget he's Philip playing these guys. He slips into the characters just so completely. And with her, it's, and it is partially the way they've set up the characters themselves. There's always that sense of, no, it's Elizabeth in a wig playing this character. And with him, it's just he just slips into these different roles. I think it's a very interesting, combination of both. Yes, that's kind of how the characters themselves are, but also an indication just of the different levels of acting talent. I just started thinking of it partially in terms of Orphan Black and with Tatiana Maslany. I mean, no, she is actually playing different people who you believe are different people. And with Philip, it's a little bit different. Where no, I mean, in the back of your mind, you know it's Philip, but the way he embodies these characters is just so complete and so believable. Also certainly, I mean, this is the classic contrast of their two styles where, you can see how successful he's being with Kimmy as much as it's completely turning you off in terms of the situation. And then, contrasting that with Elizabeth as the cold operative where you're wondering why is she going back and forth with, by this guy's house, and until you get the payoff at the end Northrop employee who she's been slowly reeling in, I thought it's very interesting the way they made it the completely anonymous guy under the car, you never see his face, so that when she drops it on him, it is just this completely cold assassination to get what she needs. So it's just sort of a reminder of their different approaches, and yes, to a certain extent, I mean, setting stuff up, but I thought in terms of the character work that was going on, it was just fascinating.
Do you think that's part of the problem this season is that they just haven't given Elizabeth enough to do? I know that they're really playing up this whole religious angle a bit, but I feel like that's just not as compelling as some of the things she's done in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I really feel like they thought that a lot of these subplots were going to be more meaty than they've been so far. I mean, the whole thing with Kimmy is just coming off as creepy. I mean, I kind of joked about, you know, Rock the Cradle of Love and all, but man, this is a pretty young girl. And yeah. even Philip is kind of like, yeah, I've got a, he used to look the look on his face. Like he thinks he's skeevy and he's the one who has to do this.
Yes, exactly. Like,
let's get high.
Yeah.
But anyway,
didn't even seem like that helped him.
No.
But certainly, I mean, compared to previous seasons, I mean, no, I mean, it is much more low key where, I mean, yes, there's the whole potential page recruitment angle, which is, is all psychological, certainly. But then in terms of these threads that they're following in their espionage lives, it's all this sort of slow approach and subversion of people. It's them taking a different tack, and as much as I felt like this episode was getting back to the character work, I can definitely see the problem of there could be more action going on, and they're keeping things much more cerebral this season.
Let's see here. I think I've actually already said kind of what was on my mind on this one. So let's move on to another episode here that has a lot of varied opinion, and that is Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Season 2, Episode 11, Aftershocks. In the wake of the war with Hydra, surprising ramifications surface and put the team's solidarity at risk. Meanwhile, Hydra's actions could unearth a traitor at S.H.I.E.L.D. And this one came in at an average of 8.13, so just barely below the Americans. Scores range from 7 to 9.5. And Henry wanted to say here for us, just wanted to say I love this episode. It had a darkness to it that I didn't even know the show could tap into. But maybe it's largely because I don't have a clue as to how the Inhuman storyline will play out. It's exciting to mirror the mindsets of some of the characters in that regard. So he really enjoyed the fact that they are kind of embarking on this Inhumans storyline. But Gary, you gave this one an average 7. So what about the return? Just, is it that it's not Peggy Carter?
No, it's not that it's not Peggy Carter, and it's not that the fashions are a little less vibrant. Anyway, it's a whole dress thing.
Sky is anyway, so damn pretty. Anyway, it's just
as a side note, I saw Nathan Fillion and Alan Tudyk between the act on either side of the actress that said Sky and that said you can't take the sky away from me. I thought that was nice. Anyway,
I don't want to. Well, maybe I do a little bit. Anyway, go ahead.
I guess it was the two woe is me storylines that we're running here, both Sky and Raina. I was expecting more anger or, maybe even more frustration than we got to see, but it was, it was like, oh, woe is me. And that sort of surprised me definitely from Raina. She had been such a strong character, all along, even when adversity struck, that to sort of see her whimpering, this whole change me back thing, I would have almost expected the character to embrace it, not to cower so much from it. So that seemed out of character for me. And then as far as Sky, I mean, she's sitting there just sort of terrified and mopey, and it didn't seem to work for me either. I mean, I understand she'd be, scared or frightened, but other than having these vibrational outbursts when she gets very upset, as far as I can tell otherwise, there really isn't anything happening to her, unless there is more, but we're not seeing it or they're not showing it at all, in which case they should have shown us maybe small little minor things a little bit more than I felt they did. They didn't express to me why she would be sort of in this constant panic state. Bobby and I forget what the guy's name is. This situation where they were looking for Fury's toolbox and they're some kind of possibly double agent seemed a little bit confusing to me. I thought they were sort of pretty well vetted for them to turn like that. That seemed, without any real foreshadowing of it, seemed a little odd. And then we find out that Hydra also doesn't have one leader, much like the namesake. There's several leaders and they each control different areas, and that's nice, but you think they would have told us that before. before now too. That it's like, you know, we thought when the one guy got killed that, you know, that they had sort of chopped off their head, but now we find out, yeah, you know, like a Hydra, they have, you know, several different heads, and that seems again out of left field from nowhere. And so I'm sort of scratching my head about either things that seem, you know, out of character, or that they're literally dropping in with no hints or anything like that, and it just didn't seem to make sense to me.
What was surprising to me was in the recap, they say that after the war with Hydra, and I was going, the war with Hydra's over? I don't think so. No. I think Baron Strucker has a few things to say about that.
Well, it might have been when they only had one leader. Now we find out there's a much more stronger organization, because they never told us before.
I think you could have assumed, but that's me. Edmund, what are your thoughts here on this?
I mean,
your highlights for this. Yeah, I gave it an 8, so I have to review over on the VOG Network's website for my opinion, but kind of curious as to yours.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, I mean, some of these reservations Gary was bringing up, I mean, to me, certainly in terms of Sky and Reyna, in terms of the way they'd set up that that mid-season finale and this sort of traumatic event that they had both gone through, and certainly the loss of Trip as far as it weighs on Sky, the fact that, you know, I don't know how much of this is a case of in the viewer community, it sort of became such a given in the break of like, oh yes, they've introduced the Inhumans, and you know, so now she's Inhuman, and yes, we know that, but she doesn't. All she knows is she managed to survive this weird thing that killed one of her friends. So I kind of saw this as the beginning of a character arc and realizations for both of them. And with Reyna, so much of her character had been about being this influencer and seductress and the girl in the flower dress. And so having that ripped away from her and being turned into this creature, her reaction actually made sense to me. Although it did amuse me having this sort of Tomorrow People rescue happen to her. In terms of what we know is coming into, you know, I actually wasn't quite sure. I was like, yeah, like, no, is that the casting choice we'd heard about? If it is, it just makes it even more appropriate. Certainly in terms of the whole taking out as many heads of Hydra, I actually rather enjoyed that with the subterfuge and the fake ambush and taking out these people who, yes, we knew they weren't really gone, but
they'll never take us alive.
You know, yes. Anyway. I still thought it was well done. So overall, I guess I was taking it more as we are now starting this new story arc after that big boom at the mid season, all these characters are going to be progressing from this point.
Yeah. That's true. One of the things I really liked is you brought up the difference between how Sky and Reyna are kind of dealing with this, and you've got the Inhumans that are kind of really treating the whole situation differently. You know, the whole thing with Reyna, like, wow, you're so beautiful, type of thing. It's like obviously a cultural thing, but the thing between Fitz and Simmons now, where Fitz of all people completely understands what Sky is going through, and that she's changed and is trying to protect her because that's what he's been going through all season. Yes. And I thought that was a really smart decision for them to use that dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, Simmons coming out as so xenophobic, you could just kind of tell how much that was getting at Sky, because it's like, you would think that, yeah, you know, probably if Simmons realized that she's talking about Sky when she's talking about exterminate all those alien people, she probably dialed it back a little bit, but there's just that little bit of concern in Sky's mind, like, well, what if she doesn't? You know, cute little Simmons is going to try to stab me. I liked the way that the characters were dealing with things. I do, Gary, to your point, have reservations about this whole thing with Bobby. I don't think that they're going to go down the same road that they did with Ward. At least I hope they don't. But, and remember, Bobby is now a regular on the series. So whether that means regular villain or regular hero, we don't know, but just something to keep in mind. Let's see here. Next on the list is The Good Wife, Season 6, Episode 13, Dark Money. Diane and Carrie represent Colin Sweeney when he accuses a TV producer of basing an unflattering character and show on him. Meanwhile, Alicia competes against Frank Prady for major campaign donation, and this episode came in with 2 scores from Henry and Nadim at an 8, so above average. So good return for The Good Wife. Next we have Arrow, Season 3, Episode 15, Nanda Parbat. Merlin is captured by Ra's al Ghul and taken to Nanda Parbat. Meanwhile, Ray becomes obsessed with finishing his Atom suit so he can save the city, but Felicity fears he is heading down the same path as Oliver and tries to pull him out of the lab. Well, she succeeded.
She certainly does, yes.
Well, this episode got an 8, so above average again. And Gary, just some thoughts on the Atom suit. What's that all about? He's Iron Man?
I'm a little surprised that they took it as full suit tech as it is. You know, I guess they're going more of the, if we are to actually, see him shrink down, say, to microscopic or something like that, maybe there's some idea about needing your own atmosphere because of the size of oxygen molecules. I've read a few different papers on things like that. But I think it's way overkill. And honestly, for the Arrow universe, it's almost over the top superhero-y. And when I say that, as you were talking about a few episodes ago when we were talking about the new Supergirl costume and how it seemed somewhat realistic or believable, that Atom suit is none of the above. It's for this universe, it's really kind of hokey, and I don't know where the heck they're going with it. There's only one alternate universe reality where I've ever seen a Atom suit along those lines, and that is so narrow and thin that I doubt anybody has ever read the Elseworlds book. Yeah. I think it was called, I'm trying to remember which one it was, but they did have Atom suits. I'm thinking it might have been the Nail, but I'm not positive. So
So what did you think of this whole turn of events where Ra's al Ghul is kind of asking Oliver to become his successor? I guess we're one step closer to Oliver just simply being Batman already.
Yeah, I was going to say it's pretty much missing the cowl at this point, because this is an exact ripoff of the whole Batman plot.
So, yeah.
Very much so. I mean, this actually happened this episode, minus the whole Talia interested in Batman / Oliver. Anyway, I don't mind them adapting comic book stuff, but literally grabbing a whole storyline like this from a completely different character seems a little cheap. On the other hand, Ra's al Ghul was and pretty much always has been a Batman villain. So, for him to be pulled over into the Arrowverse, I guess if you're going to accept Ra's al Ghul over, you can accept this motivation for Oliver. So I gave it a little bit of a cut, but at the same time, it just seems like lazy writing to lift such an obvious plot line from another superhero.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they're just doing that because they don't have the opportunity to use Batman and they just want to go ahead and do the story.
Well, I think it's more of a Ra's al Ghul feature, honestly. You're like, okay, here's something he does. Okay, so yeah. He's not doing it with Batman this time. He's going to do it with Arrow because that's what he does.
Yeah,
so
I think it would be pretty funny though if it turns out that Ra's al Ghul did all this kind of stuff, and then he asked Oliver to do this. Oliver says yes, and then he turns out to be the one who crossover with Gotham. Anyway, that was a little bit of an oddity to me, but it wasn't enough to really take away from the episode too much. It was just like, huh? But yeah, it got an average, obviously, of 8, and certainly was another good entry. And wondering if they're even going to go ahead at some point and introduce Talia. I don't know. Looks like they're trying to stick, I guess, with Nadia at this point.
No, but as a side note, I'm hoping Merlin is I'm hoping his character's going to actually be out of it for a while now that they've abducted him. I'm sort of sick of the, I'm just with him to train. You have to be tougher, Oliver.
We've had 3 or 4 episodes of that, and I don't need any more.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah, it looks like they are finally moving forward after a little bit of a... This has been an uneven season. I think we can all agree with that. So I think hopefully this will get them back on track for the rest of the run when they return relatively shortly. Next we have Vikings Season 3, Episode 2, The Wanderer. A mysterious wanderer arrives in Kattegat. Lagertha and Æthelstan establish a Viking settlement, kinda sorta, as King Ecgbert basically totally puts the moves on Lagertha again and again and again, and she's eating it up. What's really strange about this episode is that I'm not sure what the hell's going on through most of it. The Vikings that are kind of fighting with the Welsh princess, whose name I can never pronounce, like most Welsh, they're all kind of getting, for what I can tell, they're all under the influence of magic mushrooms, and they go like murderously, like just start killing people randomly when they're under the influence. And I don't know if it's supposed to be a plot point or they just decided, let's get the Vikings, like, you know, stoned and see what happens. But since it's seen from their point of view quite often throughout the episode, it's actually really confusing. That said, it was entertaining enough. I gave it an 8 because it was better than the season premiere, that's for sure. Finally, we have The Musketeer, Season 2, Episode 7, A Marriage of Inconvenience. As she travels from Mantua to Sweden, the king's cousin is ambushed while being escorted by the musketeers, because of course. Meanwhile, important figures at the court are also in danger, but by who? Or by whom even?
Yes.
By the way, if I'm the king, I might actually try to remember what my cousins look like. Just saying.
Well, you know, it's a different time period. You know, you don't, they've grown up, you know, who knows how they, what they look like now they're grown up, but.
Yeah, it's,
I'm trying to rationalize.
Yeah. Then again, it is King Louis.
Yes, that's
true. Who only knows whether or not he can rub two brain cells together.
Yes.
Anyhow, any thoughts on this one?
Just seemed like a sort of standard episode. And there was the whole conceit of the cousin who was arriving had been switched out and was actually an assassin. Did feel a little weak. I mean, they did their best in terms of the whole portrait painter subplot and using that as a device to introduce that plot point that was at least semi relevant to the time period. To a certain extent, it was more about sort of just rejiggering the relationships. Obviously, the D'Artagnan facilitating the death of his rival, how that's going to play out, and Milady, reasserting herself. But this felt a little bit like a middle of the series filler episode to just kind of move things along, give us some action, set things up for what we've kind of been expecting, the inevitable Rochefort finally figuring out who the Dauphin's father is.
Yeah, that's not going to end well.
No.
Never mind the fact that he is just obviously completely and utterly nuts,
yes.
As is evidenced again and again and again. So yep. That's going to come to a head very quickly.
Yeah, and I will just mention it. I mean, I have been enjoying Mark Maron in this over the top role, but as a sort of palate cleanser, I did have to go back and watch the opening episode of Hustle just to remind myself of what he's like as Mickey Blue, and he's a truly convincing con man.
What really still continues to rankle in this episode is yet another example of this is just the how much do these musketeers need to do before you simply stop it, like jumping down their throats every single time.
Yes.
There's the most minor of lapses. It's like sooner or later you're just make up your mind. Either you want them to protect you or you just want to blame them for everything and make them go away.
Yes.
Someone who doesn't trust the thing that they do, why do you still put them right there in every situation?
Yes.
It's like, you can't do anything right. Please accompany me.
Yeah.
Anyhow. Yes. So anyway, yeah, that's actually that was the last show on the list. If anyone else have any other thoughts, Gary, what are your thoughts to wrap up this week?
Trying to think. Well, I'm happy that Shield came back, and while I didn't think this was the best episode ever, I still like some of the plot lines that they did reveal and sort of starting to unfold, and I'm looking forward to another good season for that. I wish we'd already hear about Peggy Carter being picked back up. Let's see what else. Supergirl is starting to intrigue me. I was ready to totally let it go, but the more I start to see and hear about it, the more interesting it's becoming to me. And as you sort of hinted earlier, lose that big Adam suit. We don't need another Iron Man.
Unfortunately, I think that trigger has been pulled.
Yeah,
I know. No pun intended. With the metaphor with Felicity. Anyway, that's why we really hate it, right? He's rich, he's got an Iron Man suit, and Felicity. And,
yes.
Anyway, Edmund, how about you? Any last thoughts for this?
Yeah, well, actually, I didn't quite get a chance to weigh in on Arrow, but I mean, honestly, other than the fact that yes, it was lifting the Batman storyline, to me, it made no sense having him offer that to Oliver when... everything that's been set up this season is more about how Oliver isn't really quite ready for anything like that, and why Roz would then suddenly turn around and said, "Yes, okay, I want you to take over." So, you know, it felt like something that should happen in at least a season or two down the line. So I did find all that very strange, and especially when Oliver himself is talking about, you know, oh, I have to keep training and improve myself. So yeah, that was honestly the main reason for me rating it as good, but not quite as good as it could be. We will just have to see once the CW wind through their mini breaks of where all that goes.
Yeah, I just can't wait to talk about the 100 finale.
Yeah.
Talk. No, I'll really talk. I'm not going to rant at all or get angry very, very anyway.
Non-passionate review of the pros and cons of the episode. Yes.
Yes. Just a little preview of next week, folks.
That's right. That's right. Anyhow, yes, this has been an interesting week. And as we go through this kind of, as Edmund was mentioning, the CW is kind of in a little bit of a break. A few other shows are too. Some are returning. We even have some shows next week that are premiering. Yes, again, we have premieres as Tim Kring and his friends bring us Dig. Finally, this show that has been kind of lingering on the outside of our consciousness for a little while, as it's had production issues because of geopolitical things going
real
on.
Real life stuff things. Going on. Yes, it's lots of fun to film in the Middle East.
Isn't it, though? And then also, from what I remember, I need to remember exactly when the show is starting, but I believe that the American remake of Le Revenant is starting up on A&E soon. This time headed up by Carlton Cuse. Instead of the resurrection version of the story, we actually have a straight-up adaptation of the French version of the story. So that should be interesting to see. I think that's coming in March, so when exactly, I'm not sure. But at any rate, here we go again with our usual kind of discussion about the fact that this this whole year-long schedule is definitely fully into effect, as this year we already have on the list... And without all these new shows involved, 58. We're up to 58 shows versus the 40 that we had last year.
Yeah.
That's how much content they're throwing our way, guys. So, it's been interesting, to say the least.
Yeah, I think at this point we just have to call it the never-ending season.
As long as there's not a theme song.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google+, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.